pupils on becoming the followers of tomorrow. Nobody makes biographical history films about the great world followers. Nobody gives awards to recognize the contributions of community followers. Nobody frames their CV to highlight where they exercised strong followership in their work. Nobody's heart swells with pride when a parent comes up to them and says, you know, your daughter, your son, they're a really good follower. For that matter, when I was at Bristol Baptist College training, I never heard anybody say that we should be great followers, not leaders. In fact, when following comes up at all, it's usually seen as negative. Don't be a follower, be a leader. Don't follow the crowd. Being a follower is weak and passive. It is for people who can't think or act for themselves. Being a follower is for losers. When I was thinking about being a follower, there is one place I can think of people being encouraged to be followers, and that's on Twitter. Anybody on Twitter? Twitter is all about following. Twitter, of course, is an online social networking site, and you can connect with other people by choosing to follow them. Well, that's the language it uses. And if you're following someone, you receive everything they say through their Twitter account. So choosing who you follow requires real thought. Is this person interesting or funny or insightful? Or are they just going to tell you what they had for breakfast in the morning with a photograph too? Whose thoughts and activities do you really want to keep up with? On a Twitter account, over in the corner of the screen, there's a box entitled Who to Follow. It's always there when you log in. It contains the names and pictures of people that Twitter thinks you might want to follow. Each one of them has a little button marked Follow that you just click on, and then you're following them. A friend of mine said one particular day, Twitter went beyond social networking and became an online evangelist because it said that she could now follow Jesus Christ. It was right there, a Twitter feed for Jesus Christ with his picture and everything. She thought, oh, come on, I'm a minister. What was she going to do? Not follow Jesus Christ? So she clicked the button next to his name marked Follow. And now she regularly gets updates from Jesus Christ. I'm told that sometimes the tweets are funny, sometimes provocative, and sometimes insightful. Not all that different from the Jesus we encounter in the Bible, when you think about it. I wonder if there'd been Twitter in the first century. Jesus, the real Jesus, would have probably been very popular. Lots of people wanted to know him, to see what he was doing, and to hear what he had to say. And by the time his story happens, Jesus has made quite a name for himself. He's been barnstorming the countryside with healings and exorcisms and miracles. He's been saying a lot of things that are sometimes funny, sometimes provocative, and sometimes often as insightful. And the crowds follow everything he says and does. And of course, he's got a closer group of followers, the disciples. I don't know whether you can do that on Twitter. Can you have a closer group of followers? I'm not sure. Now, the word disciple means student or apprentice. But Jesus' students are not doing too well in class. They've been following him all over the place. They've seen everything that he's done and heard everything he said. But they can't seem to master the course material. And the scene we had read is about halfway through the Gospel of Mark. So you might say this is their midterm exam. Jesus wants to know how much of all that they have seen and heard they understand so far. He asks that simple question and yet so profound. Who do you say that I am? And somehow something clicks for Peter, and he actually comes up with the right answer. "You are the Messiah," he simply says. And he passes the test. But you can often have the right answer and still not understand anything about it. Just a few verses after, he gave Jesus the correct answer. Peter is pulling aside Jesus to tell him he has the wrong one. He begins to rebuke Jesus for saying all this stuff about the Messiah having to suffer and be rejected and killed. "What kind of Messiah is that?" Peter demands. But Jesus cuts him off. "Get behind me, Satan," he says. Now, Jesus isn't calling him Satan lightly. Remember that Jesus began his ministry with Satan beside him, tempting him to see what kind of Messiah he really would be. It seems that here Jesus too is facing that temptation again, and he too passes the test. And then he calls the crowd and the disciples around him, and he gives them all the answer to the question of what kind of Messiah he is really going to be, what kind of Messiah they are following. "If any want to be my followers," he says, "let them deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and the sake of the gospel will save it." Following Jesus takes a lot more than clicking a button and keeping up with him, knowing what he says and does, and what he had for breakfast. It means actually going where he goes and doing what he does, the way that he does it. Which is crucial, given how the phrase "take up their cross" has been abused. Usually when people say something or someone is my cross to bear, they mean suffering that is imposed on them, but which must nevertheless be accepted and endured without complaint. But I don't think that's what Jesus is saying. We don't take up our cross and follow Jesus by quietly accepting and enduring the violence of a spouse or the manipulations of a drug-addicted child. Suffering that is imposed on us against our will is not really redemptive. Suffering on the cross was not imposed on Jesus. He took it upon himself willingly, intentionally, to save all of us. To take up your cross and follow Jesus means we follow him in refusing to think only about ourselves, but to suffer for the redemption of others, even if it risks us losing our lives too. Someone many years ago wrote about the American civil rights struggle and said what redemptive suffering is really like. He wrote this: "Now, before then, I'd felt like there was a hole in the philosophy of nonviolent existence. What do you do when somebody else is being violently attacked? Do you just stand there keeping your hands clean and ask the attacker to stop instead of driving them away? That's hard to accept. If somebody is being attacked and beaten, it is your responsibility to intervene to protect them. But intervening does not mean returning violence with violence to drive the attacker away. Intervening means stepping in and shielding your fellow marcher with your own body, accepting the blows yourself in order to save them, even at the risk of losing your own life." "Oh," I thought, he writes, "I guess that's an option I hadn't considered, and it was hard to accept, but mostly because I didn't want to, because there isn't much question that he was talking powerfully about them really taking up their cross and following Jesus. They were just going a lot further than I wanted to have to go." Those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. In other words, following Jesus is for losers. The question is, what are we willing to lose? Now, to save or to lose our lives as followers of Christ isn't always a dramatic kind of decision like the American civil rights activists or that which the first century Christians faced. In fact, that's a pretty rare opportunity for most of us in the church in the 21st century and in the UK. But it's no less real. A church that's focused on saving its own life will lose it. A church that spends its energy and resources saving its building rather than empowering its mission is losing its life. A living church makes its building a resource for mission, not an object of itself. A church seeking new members to save its budget or to influence is losing its life. A living church receives new members to nurture them as disciples, not so that they can nurture the church as an institution. I remember a number of years ago, one Sunday, a visitor arrived and she'd just moved into Carn. And she'd had a number of conversations with people in the congregation. And then one of the people she'd had a conversation with came up to me afterwards and said, "Did you talk to her?" I said, "Yes, I did. She'd be really good here because she's good at this and this and this and this." We too often think like that. What if the living church receives people into the life of the church to nurture them as disciples? The losing our lives for the sake of the gospel does not always mean death, but it does mean martyrdom. Now, we think of martyrs as people who died for their faith, who literally lost their lives for the sake of Jesus and the gospel. But that's not the original meaning. Martyr is a Greek word which means witness. And what does a witness do? A witness tells the truth of what they have seen and heard, no matter what. It's just that in the first three centuries of the church, telling the truth about how you had seen and heard Jesus' saving grace in your life and in the world was enough for you to get killed. But the significance wasn't actually in losing your life for your faith. The significance was in being a witness who gives testimony that you have already lost your life when Christ claimed it, and that it is held safely in Christ's hands where no one on earth can reach it. I was once told that at the height of the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, when Christians were literally suffering and dying for justice and redemption there, Archbishop Desmond Tutu used to gather his staff around him in the mornings for prayer. And often as he was closing the prayer, he would ask, "If being Christian became a crime, would there be enough evidence to convict us? If being a Christian became a crime, would there be enough evidence to convict us?" I think he was asking the question to keep himself and his staff focused on who and whose they were, rather than just on what they were doing. They were not simply leaders leading an important social struggle for dignity and freedom. They were followers, followers of Jesus Christ in insisting that God's reconciling love transcends everything that tries to resist it. And the apartheid movement and apartheid challenged in insisting that different races could not and should not live together. Without being followers, being leaders was not enough. People had to be able to see and hear them following Christ in their lives and ministry for their leadership to really make sense in the first place. Perhaps we need to set up colleges for Christian followership. As much as the church needs leadership, and it does, that's not going to count for much if we're not developing our followership. In fact, every church should be a center of Christian followership, a place where we help each other become losers. Losers of everything that keeps us from following Jesus. Imagine the sign at the end of the drive. We're losers. Losers of anything that keeps us from following Jesus. Our fears and anxieties, our pasts, our futures, our status, our schedules, our need to be in control of our lives and our faith. Anything that keeps us from losing ourselves in the abundance of the grace that we receive, the love we share, and the ministry that we're called to carry out. As it turns out, you and I have a lot to lose. So let's get on losing. All we have to do is follow the leader.